6:38, Seattle's Morning News. Our biggest summer festival is going to be scuttled by the pandemic. Here's Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch.
For a second year in a row, Seafair will largely be a virtual event.
Planning a multi-week festival takes months.
And spokesman Patrick Harrison says the reality is it's unclear when more COVID restrictions will be lifted.
You know, we have to plan for the phase that we're in, not for the phase that we hope to be this summer.
That means no large gatherings, even outside, or events that draw them. But thanks to flight simulators, the Navy's Blue Angels will tear across a virtual blue sky, and hydroplane drivers will compete online.
It's like it's a video game, but they are in their own boats. And we've created a digital virtual space of the Lake Washington race course.
Locations for 5K runs will soon be announced that you can presumably run on your own while practicing social distancing.
People can do their own 5K, and so they'll get, you know, T-shirts as they typically do. They'll get medals as they typically do. And we'll send out prizes based upon their timing.
As for parading through Seattle,
you know, torchlight parade down Fourth Avenue, you know, that's hundreds of thousands of people. And we just will be able to do that.
Instead, Seafair caravans will head into neighborhoods on different weekends. Come on, this is not going to be the same. Harrison gets that.
You know, we were really hoping that the state and the city would use Seafair, in particular the 4th of July, as kind of that emergence of celebrating community, celebrating the nation's independence, but coming out of this. And we're just not quite there yet.
But in a sign of optimism that we will be quite there yet and more, plans are already being set for next year. Harrison says an actual performance by the Blue Angels has already been booked.
Well, that's reassuring anyway. Those events will kick off on June 18th. You can find a list at seafair.org. Just 4 days left in this legislative session. There's still a lot of work to do. Car Radio's Hannah Scott is here with where things stand on several issues like police reform, a capital gains tax, and the rush to fix the state's repealed drug possession law. Hannah.
That's right. So we had a lot of police accountability bills as we headed into session. I think there was close to 24 when we started out that really ran the gamut. So we have several of them that have passed, including a couple of these week that deal directly with some of the issues that we saw in the case of George Floyd. One of those bills is the decertification process that passed yesterday from the legislature and is headed to the governor's desk. He is expected to sign this. This is the bill that really creates it was described as the teeth of the entire police accountability efforts in the legislature, right? Because it creates that process or better defines that process of decertifying an officer, basically taking away their license for behaving badly, but also includes a lot of other aspects such as intense background checks that are going to be necessary now in order to hire a police officer. And then that goes in turn with another bill that already passed that creates a database for any bad behaving officers statewide so that we have the ability to make sure that they're not able to leave one department and just go laterally move to another when they've done something without anyone else knowing about it, which had been an issue in the past. This decertification bill came from Democratic Senator Jamie Peterson. He's the bill's prime sponsor, and he described yesterday the changes that had been made in the House before the final vote.
Expanding the Criminal Justice Training Commission to 21 members, which allowed the addition of some additional law enforcement and line officer representation in the commission while still maintaining the community member majority on the commission itself.
So that commission is, of course, the Criminal Justice Training Commission. They'd be the ones tasked with deciding whether or not an officer is going to be decertified when something happens. This can be use of force. It also defines in this bill some other areas where they can have kind of a graduated point system that based on different kinds of misconduct that would eventually lead to decertification. And it was a civilian majority on that panel, which was a very big deal, and that was added into this bill. And it remains still a civilian majority. It's just larger, with a little more law enforcement voice than it originally had. The other big change?
Removing the ability of the commission to suspend an officer before any due process happened, before a disciplinary panel was convened. I think that both of these changes, as well as the other more technical changes that the House made, are good and appropriate and advance the purpose of the bill.
But not all Republicans necessarily agreed with that. Republican Senator Mike Patton not as confident and expressed concern.
Concerns about all these detailed changes, some of which are fine, but some of which are quite problematic.
And what you're hearing from Republicans here, especially on this bill, is that it's so far-reaching. It perhaps gives too much power to the Criminal Justice Training Commission, making it, instead of a training, you know, organization, which is what it had primarily been, much more of a regulatory kind of accountability agency. And so there was some concern about that among Republicans and among most of the law enforcement groups. There was some of the bills that have passed, law enforcement groups could get behind some of the bills, but not this one. There was, again, that same concern about the power being put in the hands of the Criminal Justice Training Commission. Another big bill that passed was the duty to intervene bill, which I think we've talked about before. It requires officers to do something. If in a case like we saw with George Floyd, where you've got three officers standing around watching what Derek Chauvin was doing, they would be required to intervene. If not, they would end up going through this decertification process. And a great many other things. They have to report different kinds of misconducts and things of that nature. Democratic Representative Jesse Johnson is the sponsor of that bill. He's also the sponsor of a couple of other bills, one that has to do with use of force, defining exactly when and how officers should use force, and another banning certain tactics like chokeholds and neck restraints. Now, those two bills, there's been some disagreement over one particular part, and that's tear gas.
This is a really, really big discrepancy and challenge, because you have, you know, Senator Peterson and others that believe that, you know, tear gas should not be used at any riots. And, you know, you had Senator Patton and others that believe that it should be used widely. And then the governor weighed in, who believed tear gas should be used. And so we really had to work out language, and conference is actually tomorrow, but I'm very confident the language we've landed on won't make everyone happy, but they'll be able to move forward with it.
Now, that conference is actually today, because I had interviewed him a day before yesterday. But basically what this language that he's talking about is, and I think I included some of this yesterday, is the mayor of a city would have to make the call if a police agency is going to use tear gas in a riot. But it does allow that tear gas in a riot, which is one of the big sticking points that many Democrats didn't want. So that's something we'll see what comes out of that this morning. And this isn't going to be the end of the police accountability discussion in Olympia. Johnson says bills that did not cross the finish line this year will be back next year.
I know that we tried to touch on criminal liability in our use of force bill, House Bill 1310, but we could not get there. And it was just too much controversy on that. So we settled with use of force for civil liability. But I think criminal liability will be an important next step, especially as it pertains to qualified immunity, which is another bill by Rep. Ty that did not move forward this year. So I think just right there, there's a couple areas that we can address next year.
So that'll all come up next year. A lot of other bills also that passed. We've got independent investigations that was created and several others. I'll wrap up later down after the session is over. But a lot of significant progress there. The other bill making progress, and I know you're interested in, Dave, is the capital gains tax bill. It passed the Senate much earlier in the session. And yesterday, after 2 days of debate, I think it was many, many hours, Senate Bill 5096, which creates a 7% tax on the capital gains of the sale of assets such as bonds and stocks above $250,000, passed in the House. And it was much to the chagrin of many Republicans. Here's some of what they had to say.
Such a monumental, historic day where this House is voting for an income tax, and we're going to prevent the people from having an opportunity to have a say.
It attempts to circumvent constitutional restrictions to implement an income tax in the state of Washington.
In 2010, 60% of them voted no when this was on a statewide ballot, because they know what's going to happen. That level is going to get lower and lower and lower. Before you know it, everybody's filing an income tax return, paying income taxes, whether it's on capital gains or whatever else.
Washington State's own governor's budget sets it at 9% for earners at $25,000.
Sounds like that's not going to get bipartisan support.
No, definitely not. I mean, and there is a big fight against this. And it's been close, you know. It's not a done deal. There's differences between the two versions that passed, so it's got to go back to Senate for concurrence, and we'll see what happens there. There's been some strange things that happen here. The original version included an emergency clause, but this doesn't get collected until 2023, so I think it was Steve Hobbs said, you know, this is not an emergency. Let's take that out. And the issue with the emergency clause is that it prevents a public referendum. It prevents the people from putting this to a vote. And as we know, the people have voted against an income tax, is what you'll hear from Republicans. And that's what they say this is. Now, this bill that just passed last night, that emergency clause was stripped out. But there is this very rare line that was inserted into the middle of the bill that reads very much the same. And the feeling from Republicans is that it would do the same thing, prevent that public vote. I'm still waiting to get a straight answer on that from the Democrats. I haven't had one yet.
I saw that line. Very sneaky.
Very sneaky.
All right, Hannah. Thank you.
You bet.
It's time for the Daily Dose of Kindness now. It's brought to you by Robert W. Baird and Company, Incorporated. A local teen's heroic mission to fight cancer took her on a journey that no one expected, and Cairo 7 TV's Tracy Leung has the story.
Shaving my head because I reached over $30,000.
For what?
For blood cancer.
It's a selfless gesture to show solidarity with cancer patients.
Oh, wow.
For 16-year-old Mercy Hobb, it's a deeply personal mission that started at a young age when her best friend's father lost his battle to cancer.
So I wanted to, you know, contribute my efforts to the fight against cancer for the majority of my life.
The Shoreline teen promised to shave her head and donate the hair if she raised more than $30,000 for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. But this moment of celebration in the summer of 2020 was short-lived. Weeks later, Hobb was diagnosed with stage 2 Hodgkin lymphoma.
It was a sad moment. I will also say there was hope in there because she knew what she had worked so hard for and what so many people were working hard for to help her and help these other patients.
LLS campaign manager Danica Smith offered guidance to Hobb throughout her fundraising competition and continued to be there for her after the diagnosis.
She had this sense of grace and a sense of poise that that stayed with her and that kept her going because she knew that Leukemia Lymphoma Society was behind her.
The Shorewood High School junior started treatment in November and remained optimistic throughout this difficult journey.
Had this kind of hope and that people like the people at the LLS and the people who had done the things that I had done as, you know, being in the Students of the Year program, I knew that there were people working to help people like me now.
Hobb has spent so much of her life dedicated to helping others. And it was during these challenging months of treatment that Hobb saw an overwhelming amount of love and support when she needed it the most. On Hobb's final day of chemo in March, friends, neighbors, and loved ones lined the streets to celebrate this milestone.
If all our volunteers would have the drive that she has, I think, you know, starting as a fundraiser and then being a patient, but then continuing to say, like, what can I do next?
Three, two, one.
A joyful sound to end treatment. And even underneath her mask, Hobb couldn't hide her bright smile as she looks ahead to an even brighter future.
Hopefully provide a face to my peers when we're, you know, working towards this cure scientifically and be like, hey, I'm still here because someone thought, why don't we try this kind of drug? And so we should have that same attitude and hopefully save some lives.
Reporting in Seattle, Tracy Leung.
And now from the Gian Ursula Show, which starts at 9 o'clock here on Cairo Radio. G. Scott, another virtual seafarer this year, so are you bummed or not?
Yeah, I'm bummed. Come on, man. We've had enough. Yes. It's like going to the zoo, a virtual zoo. Hey, boys and girls. We're gonna
go
to the zoo.
My kids loved it. Virtual zoos was like a savior during the pandemic when there wasn't very much schooling going on.
How old are your kids?
Well, she's going to be 8 soon and then an almost 2-year-old. So.
Okay. The 2-year-old, yeah. The 8-year-old really liked it?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Well, I'm sorry. I need the real zoo and I need real seafair. Hey, guys, look, I don't want to just like I need some normalcy. Now, look, I know, we know that there is a pandemic going on. Ain't no doubt about it. But sometimes you have to give folks some type of reward, some type of, look, I know things been rough. We're going to open it up, let it happen. But it's like competing. Like with my kids when they were coming up, right? Like I hear about parents sometimes like, oh, I only let my kids play one sport and then they train year round. That is the dumbest thing in the world, because sometimes you want to give kids an opportunity to compete. Games are fun. Well, that's how I look at this whole COVID thing and what we've been going through for over a year. Yo, we've been locked down a long time. I need a little seafair in my life to just let me know. You hear that? Oh,
okay,
man.
Okay. How about this? I see you're upset. So
I am upset.
The only way I see out of this, because, I mean, it could end up being a super spreader event. You got to acknowledge that, right? So the only compromise would be hold seafair, but the price of admission.
Vaccination?
That's right. Is your vaccination card?
I'm cool with that.
Yeah?
Yes, I'm cool with that.
And that'd be an incentive for people to get it.
I feel like that's controversial, and you don't even need to. Listen, I have a number of people I know who have gone to Disney World, and they have done it. And I know it's Disney World, and Seafair doesn't have the kind of money that Disney has, but everybody wears their masks. They have volunteers around reminding people to put their masks over their nose, and everybody's happy to do it because they're happy to just be there, feeling like they're doing something normal with their children. I really do feel like Seafair, which is an outdoor activity, can successfully keep people's masks on, and we can enjoy some normal.
Come on, Colleen.
An arena concert. This isn't a rally. This is a widespread outdoor event where, if given the proper volunteer staffing, you can do it. This is weird that Seafair would put it on hold again.
Colleen, you ain't never preached this much before 8 o'clock.
And I appreciate your support. I was feeling real good with the, come on.
I mean, Dave,
yes.
Where are you at on this?
I mean, I'm a rule follower, man. If they came up with some sort of rule and they said you got to wear a mask or you got to have a vaccination card, this is what we're going to do to keep you safe, I'd say, okay, and then make the decision whether to go or not. Now, fundamentally for me, even in normal times, I avoid crowds. I don't wait in line overnight for movies. If some new store is in demand, or, you know, people are lining up for a new restaurant, I wait until it dies down and then I go. But that's just me. I'm just looking for a way to satisfy you and satisfy Colleen and satisfy the anti-vaxxers. And I realize it's a hopeless cause.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's hard.
Let me say one last thing. Preacher's kids growing up. Some of my friends were kids of the preacher and they were real strict. They wouldn't let them do anything. Nope, can't do this. Nope, you can't do that. You know what I learned?
What?
Every time the kids, they couldn't do anything, and their parents were so strict, them was always the one finding a way to do something on the other end. I'm going with that. Sometimes, Governor Jay Inslee, state of Washington, you got to give us a little bit of freedom. Because if you start saying nope to this and nope to that, then you know what we end up doing? We start having large gatherings at our homes and say, forget it. We can't do nothing else. Let's just have 50 to 100 people at our house. Would you rather have that, or would you rather us be outside, like Colleen was saying, outside, mask on, out in the air, seafair? Come on. Give us something.
Yep. And in fact, in my own personal life, we're going to experiment with this tomorrow. We have a group of guys that meets on a monthly basis. We've been doing it on Zoom. But now that we have our vaccinations, we are going to meet in person, outside, distanced, and eat an actual lunch and talk out loud.
Dave.
Scandalous.
I just want to know what's on the menu for you guys.
I don't know. I'm not buying, so we'll find out.
Why do I have a feeling it's going to be like some potato salad,
deli salads. I was just going to say
with raisins in it and pecans.
It's going to be high fat burgers at the Roanoke, but that's none of your business.
Ooh, yum yum.
Ooh, okay, Dave.
And King County could become the first county in the nation to ban the government use of facial recognition technology. And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is here to tell us why.
Why is because there's a growing use of the this technology, of course, by police agencies across the country, and it's kind of going piecemeal through various cities and counties where they're deciding whether that's an okay thing or not. Now, there's already a new state law that's set to kick in this July that would limit the use of facial recognition technology by government agencies. But King County Councilmember Jeannie Cole Wells thinks the county should go even further and ban its use altogether.
How much surveillance power by a government do we need? Do we really need to track people by their race? Do we need really to profile and monitor people based on really secret algorithms? And do we really need to create databases that can be exploited by ICE in our immigration systems and other government agencies? I'm very concerned about the direction that we're going in. And I believe that we as a county government have a, we should have a policy to lead with racial equity as the driving force for how we develop laws and priorities. That's what we're about.
Now, several people who came to share their thoughts at yesterday's meeting agreed.
This technology poses unprecedented privacy, civil liberties, and equity concerns.
Who in a free society wants to have the only means of opting out of this surveillance is by never leaving one's home.
The ACLU came to explain the primary issues.
This technology disproportionately misidentifies people of color, women, trans people, and non-binary people, supercharging discrimination.
Jake Parker is with the Security Industry Association, and he tells Cairo 7 TV the tech from the leading companies does not have a bias problem. And he warns that this ban is a mistake that could lead to concerning consequences.
It also would ban important applications of the technology that really have nothing to do with surveillance, including use of the tools available to law enforcement to help find missing children who are involved in human trafficking. Many thousands of them have been rescued through use of the technology in the last couple of years.
There, Jeannie Cole Wells was firm, though, on her position.
I'm just too concerned about all that could go wrong with what we have now. And it is our most vulnerable and already marginalized populations that are suffering disproportionality from its application now. So I feel very strongly about this. And I think it's very appropriate for our county to take this step and impose a ban.
I know there was research, Hannah, showing that indeed minorities were misidentified more often, at least in the studies. But what about in real world use? Are there any numbers on that?
No numbers that I had seen as this came up in the county council yesterday. And I think there was some data, and I don't have it in front of me. If you remember, right before the pandemic, last legislative session, the state legislature passed this bill that's going to limit the use of facial recognition by government agencies. It doesn't go as far as what Jeannie Cole Wells is talking about, but I believe they had some data on that as well. And that was a very contentious bill. If I remember correctly, I think it took two sessions to eventually get it passed, because there's concern. And I think what the legislature ended up doing was leaving in the ability for law enforcement to use it for, I think, silver alerts and missing kids and things like that. Mm-hmm. But not just, you know, a blanket use where they for police agencies, basically.
Hmm. I mean, there's always the option of you of it can't be used as absolute proof that you did something, right? But it can help police decide who to question. Right,
and that's exactly it. And so I think when you're having that discussion, it becomes kind of like the genetic genealogy, right? So they can't use that finding of that person as they're in court, but they can use that as a tip and then go from there to look at a specific person or something like that. And again, that's what you hear the arguments about, is that tends to end up, there's misidentification. It disproportionately affects people of color and various sexual identities, things like that. And that's the issue that the critics have, and the ACLU especially.
Aye, aye.
Choke points. It's been 4 months since the new Muckleteel Ferry Terminal opened to the public, but when it opened, it didn't have all of its bells and whistles. Those are going to be going in, though, over the next week, and Chris is here to tell us what they are.
Yeah, one of them is a super biggie, and it's the work started on that yesterday to punch through the new road that will eventually provide direct access from Highway 525 to the terminal. It's going in right where the old terminal was, and it will be called First Street. So over the last 4 months, riders have had to use a temporary road to drive that extra third of a mile to the new loading area, and that's going to change.
When we opened the new terminal on December 29th, we used a temporary road to get people to the new terminal because we needed to demolish the old terminal structures, the toll plaza. There was a staff offices there and a few other things. We needed to get rid of all of that so we could punch that new road through to 525.
The ferry services, Diane Rhodes, says the temporary lane didn't really make getting in and out of the terminal easy.
The road that we have right now is this curvy road that kind of winds around some of the construction. And that, you know, that creates its own problems because it's windy and narrow and single lane in both directions.
If the weather holds over the next few days, workers will begin transitioning cars to those new lanes.
They will pave the south part of it first, move the traffic over there from the temporary road that we've been using for the last 3+ months, and then pave the north side of it. And then when it's finished, there'll be two lanes going into the terminal and two lanes coming out.
And all of that work should be completed by next week, again, if the weather holds. Workers will also be adding a new signal at First Street and Highway 525, which will be a change for everybody, who, whether you're using the ferry or not, because there never was a signal there before. There never was a road there before. That's all going to happen in May. To make things flow a little bit better, they're going to add the new sidewalks along that new road, also to be opening in May. Rhodes says walk-on passengers are also going to notice a big change with the first sailings come Monday. The overhead walkway from the new terminal is opening. The old terminal never had overhead access, meaning walkers had to share with the car deck, and it's been that way at the new terminal too.
You've got to sit in your car until all the walk-off passengers walk off via the car deck. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. They can just walk off at the same time that you drive off, and that improves efficiency, but it's also safer for like passengers with disabilities to be able to just use that overhead walkway versus having to go over the car deck.
So opening up the overhead walkway, opening up the roadway should be big improvements that will make a big difference for ferry users. But of course, we got a little bit of pain. Construction started yesterday, as I mentioned. They're planning to do some more next week. Again, depending on the weather, they had a lane blocked on the northbound section as you tried to make your way into the Muckleteo area. So be prepared.
We're going to have uniformed police officers there and flaggers directing traffic. But we've warned people to avoid peak hours if they can, and if they can't, just bring a lot of patience because it's going to be a little bit slower.
So just pad in a couple extra minutes on your schedule trying to get down to the ferry, or if you're heading down to the Lighthouse Beach Park or things like that, to breweries or to Ivers, whatever, just because of construction. But yeah, some good stuff kind of finally coming as they really kind of complete that new terminal, which is fabulous, by the way. It's incredibly beautiful. Yeah. You can ring my
bell. Ring my bell. Brought to us by Chevrolet Buick GMC of Puyallup. Let's talk about happiness with a fundamentally happy person. That would be Rachel Bell, who's been studying this year's index of the happiest countries in the world.
Every single year, the United Nations Sustainable Development Solutions Network, they need a shorter name,
yes,
puts out this, I don't even know the acronym is, UNSTSNU.
Yes.
They put out a report every year that evaluates the happiness of people around the world. And, you know, every year, it's basically the same thing. It's some Scandinavian country. And for the fourth year in a row, it is Finland. So the World Happiness Report uses data from interviews of more than 350,000 people in 95 countries. They go through Gallup, and they used to do this a different way. They used to, you know, base it on things like life expectancy and income, but that wasn't really working. So what they do now is they actually interview people and they ask questions like, did you smile or laugh a lot yesterday? Did you learn or do something interesting yesterday? Were you treated with respect all day yesterday? And you got to hope that you did something yesterday.
Yes.
Like, does this just have to be yesterday? Yeah. Some of the questions are about trust. So someone who thought the police or strangers were, quote, very likely to return a wallet had a higher life evaluation score than somebody who thought the opposite. So going back to Finland, when Finland heard the results, they were like, again, really? Like,
bored.
They don't care.
Yeah.
They're bored and they don't really get it, because I think, you know, when you live somewhere, you just take your lifestyle for granted. It is what it is. And just to give a little bit about the culture in Finland that was provided in the article I read, when the government, you know, announced coronavirus restrictions in Finland, they said, oh, we have to stand 2 meters apart. Can't we just stick to the usual 4 meters that we usually stand? And they have a popular local saying, which is happiness will always end in tears. So doesn't sound like the happiest country in the
well,
world.
It's just they're happy because their expectations are so low.
Exactly. That's what they said. They are melancholy people. They are reserved. But what they don't do in Finland, which is a huge thing in America, is they don't have that keeping up with the Joneses mentality. So that is because, and this, you know, I lived in Japan for a year and it was very similar there. There's a lot more equality. There's not this big gap between rich and poor. You know, everybody makes around the same amount of money. The country has an excellent public school system. They don't test children regularly. They have universal health care. Childcare is affordable. College is free. And during the pandemic, they have such high trust in government that they had little resistance to people following the rules, which is why they kind of got past it quicker. So there's a lot of trust. You know, like it's not uncommon to see a little kid like a 7-year-old walking to school on their own. So all of this is why Finnish people are the happiest. Also, like you said, they have realistic expectations about their lives. And then if something does go better than they think it will, they prefer a self-deprecating joke over bragging. There's a lot of humility and keeping happiness a secret, if you will. So just to put it in perspective, the U.S. is number 14 on the list, which I was actually surprised. I would have thought we were lower than that.
Yeah, I can vouch for Finland because I've been there actually on a fact-finding tour. So I got to talk to a bunch of experts about this. And one of the things about Finland is a lot of stuff is just taken care of for you by the government. And the reason for that is that Finland, as you might know, has a very assertive neighbor and a very large neighbor, that being Russia, which at one point was had absorbed the country. And so they have this existential angst, if you will, that they cannot afford to lose one Finnish person. You can't afford when a Finnish child is born. They provide nursing. They offer nursing care right away. The daycare centers will keep a kid overnight. They're all staffed by teachers who have master's degrees. And it's provided to you, as is college, as is a retirement plan. So a lot of the things that cause so much anxiety in Americans just are not in play there.
Yeah, it's like, you know, what is happiness? I think, like they said in the article, it's more of a contentedness. You know, it's not like they're walking around with these creepy smiles, throwing confetti everywhere they go. They just don't have to worry about a lot of the things that people in a lot of other countries do. And it's interesting, everything that you just mentioned, every single person in America would say, I want that. But a lot of people don't want to pay for it because it would be hard now to suddenly switch and raise taxes a whole bunch to give the universal health care. We have a much more me society. Like, I don't want to pay more for you. Where in Finland, they're used to, you know, the better good for all.
Exactly right. Yes, because they faced extinction as a country at one point, and they understand it's important to have each other's back. And it's true about the equality thing, too, because they drove us around to some of the, they said that this is our wealthy section. And I said, well, that sort of looks like, you know, the center of Mercer Island or something. You know, it's not like the Highlands. There's no San Simeon there. The CEOs live, you know, much as a middle class American family would live. And so you don't have that the feeling that you're a failure just because you don't have the nicest house on the block. So in the past 24 hours, have you laughed?
I have, but not like a big chortle. I've had like, you know, some little, like I was listening to a podcast walking down the street by myself and looked like a crazy person because every 15 minutes I go, ha! So that was the extent of my laughter. But what about you?
Yes, because I talk to you every day.
Oh, yeah. I know I laugh with you. That's true. Because I was going to say, actually, in the last 24 hours, I haven't seen anybody, but I've talked to my coworkers down the line.
Good for you. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
Don't you feel happier just having heard that?
Yes. I wonder if you broke down the United States into happy states as well, where Washington would rank, or if you could split the state down the middle of West Side happy, East Side happy. Yeah. I have my hunches, but
I'm sure it's been done. I'm sure some website has some sort of clickbait involving which state is happy.
Where do you think the happiest state is, if you were just to guess? Because I don't know. But
the happiest state? Probably the ones that have the best climate, except you'd say Hawaii, right? Except I hear that might not be the case.
Well, the cost of living there is so high.
Well, you sort of feel stuck there.
And you got all these tourists creeping around. I feel like Montana would be happy.
Montana.
Lots of space.
I'll let you know.
Leave me alone.
I'm going there in a few hours.
Are you?
By the way, I'm just trying to figure out, when did the Finnish all turn into Rip Taylor? Running around throwing confetti all over each other? What was it? What was Rachel talking about? It's
like, I actually don't know.
You don't know? Okay.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.